episode 36 of Good Copy, Bad Copy. I'm Emily King, Ranix's Content Marketing Manager, and today I'm joined by Fiona Campbell-Howells, Ranix's Founder and Lead Copywriter.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by our Creative Director, David McGuire.
Hello. There's not much room in our tiny pod.
To be fair, if we'd been trying to record this in my car when there's normally just two of us, that's tight enough. Three of us just wouldn't be working.
It's not a huge car.
We once recorded our podcast under some chairs.
This is true.
Do you remember that? In a tent. Yeah. Like built a fort under some chairs in our meeting.
I just love the mental image that we're building for the listener here.
We've got photos.
We're all three of us squeezed into a tiny, tiny box. What? Tell us, Emily, what could be so important that it takes three of us to discuss it?
Oh, well, we said this month we're discussing, for this episode, we're discussing findings from Pro Copywriter Network's lovely survey on the UK copywriting scene, and basically had over 600 respondents from a variety of copywriting backgrounds sort of feed in with the interesting information like how much they get paid, how much they charge, you know, what gender they are, yeah, nice little tidbits like that, or are they in an agency, are they in-house, are they a freelancer? And we're going to discuss some of these findings and what they mean, perhaps in the wider sort of B2B sense, and just sort of like for copywriters in general.
Some of the outcomes were really weird.
Yes.
It is a really interesting survey, and I think it's like hats off to pro copywriters for doing that survey.
Absolutely.
Because I think it really has shone a light on, you know, what goes on in copywriting in the UK. And I think as Tom Albrighton, who wrote it up, says in the intro, you know, that it's a very fragmented scene. Lots of people are freelancers, lots of people work on their own, and there's not really that much of a sense of community or a profession. So I think this survey's done quite a lot to help bring some cohesion to the industry. So great on that score.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know, you know, having been to their conference, there's all these, you know, copywriters that have emerged from their little cellars and they're kind of blinking into the light and seeing each other going, I'm not the only one. I mean, working here with a team of writers, just, you have no idea. Well, you probably, I don't know if you remember since, you know, you've had so many writers around, but what a luxury it is to be able to go, could someone give me an opinion on this comma, please?
Yeah.
And get seven opinions.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you're a freelancer, things like Twitter have helped with that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you still feel, I think, you're on your own and working from your bedroom or whatever.
Yeah, that's so very much putting things right out there in public, though, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely.
So, getting people's responses in private, making it anonymous, and then, you know, collating all that information. Yeah. And it certainly gets everybody talking.
Yeah. So I think we're probably straying from the point. Emily, what should we talk about first?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things was whether or not anyone had actually had any formal training in copywriting. Like, people had been educated to various levels who had responded, like, you know, some people only got up to GCSE level or postgraduate level, but actually having specific training in copywriting. And, 55% of respondents said that they had not had any training specific to copywriting.
Yeah, and I think that rings true. I mean, I know I never had any specific training in it. I came into copywriting like lots of other people from a quite roundabout route. I worked in PR, first of all, and quickly realised that the only bit of PR that I enjoyed was writing the press releases, and I just couldn't cope with taking journalists out for lunch and schmoozing people at press events. And I got lots of good feedback for the stuff that I wrote, so I thought, well, I'll do this for a living. And you didn't think, oh, you know, I need to get some training. I already had clients that were already saying, oh, the writing you're doing for us is really good, so I didn't feel like I needed any specific training. So it's all been kind of, you know, on the job and learning as I go. And there's an awful lot of resource out there now to kind of learn and up your game without doing any formal training. You know, you only have to look at Copyblogger and all the resources they've got there and all their kind of courses and modules that you can download and do that, you know, that doesn't seem to be that much of a need, I don't think, to go through a kind of formal training process before you can start as a copywriter.
No, I agree. I had, you know, a fairly similar route into it. I think, you know, a lot of people did. You know, I ended up you know, as in a marketing and PR department, ended up being the guy that did all the writing. Yeah. Oh, we need something writing. We'll give it to David. He does that really well. You know, and so, oh, okay. So that appears to be the bit I'm good at then.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of people I know came into it that way. I didn't have any formal training on it for years and years and years. Although not so long ago, I think a year or two ago, I did end up doing some training. There was a masterclass with John Simmons.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I've got to say, was brilliant.
Mm.
Just spent, you know, 2 days just focusing on practice, finding out what other people do, doing a lot of exercises and things that, hands up at the time, when he's going, oh, now try this technique, try that technique, and bringing stuff in from the creative writing sphere. And I'm kind of thinking, this is kind of flaky.
Yeah.
And then I found it's really useful and I use them all the time. And hands up, yeah, brilliant. And actually, I found it valuable. But as a way of building on the experience that I already had. And I think, as you alluded to, Emily, one of the really interesting things that you kind of, where you look at the pro copywriters survey outcomes and you go, what, really? You know, you earn half as much money again if you haven't done A-levels.
Yeah, that's quite a suspicious result, isn't it? I don't understand that one at all. You know, it's like if you've got A-levels, if you've got a degree, if you've got a postgraduate degree, you're earning roughly the same at 38 grand. But if you've only got GCSEs, your average earnings is 58 grand. It's like, what's going on there? I'm not entirely sure about that.
I mean, I think experience counts for a lot, you know, and someone that you could find that, you know, if you left school at 16, you could have come into, you know, gone through a range of sales jobs and other things that would give you insights and help to feed your writing.
Mm-hmm.
You could end up being somebody that's really driven. It could just be a statistical quirk.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff that I want to talk about a bit later with the location stuff, I think could be, it could be that out of everyone that responded, 3 people had only done GCSEs. I didn't see the statistics on who had how many, just what they earned. So it could be a thing that's a statistical quirk as well, or it could be something where experience, life experience or writing experience counts for a lot.
I'm kind of in two minds about this, you know. Do you need training or don't you need training?
But you did pay for me to go on that business writing one day course that one time. And
yeah, I believe in other people doing training.
Yeah.
Just not myself, clearly.
Yeah.
Did Fiona spend her money wisely?
Well, obviously, I'd already done like a master's in professional writing. And and while perhaps reminding me of some editing techniques that perhaps I wasn't, pulling out for myself when I had written something and needed to go back over it, on the technique side, it wasn't as useful for business-to-business copy as it could have been. There was a huge focus on business-to-consumer, and it wasn't in a very transferable way either. So it wasn't as helpful as it could have been for me in this particular context. If I was in my previous job, it would have been helpful, but I'm no longer writing like articles about why, you know, Valentine's Day is Valentine's Day and trying to make it seem like a good thing rather than the corporate
bits. That's highly transferable to technology and data storage and software and cloud services. Fiona, I'm interested about that actually, because obviously, Fiona, you recruit a lot of writers.
Yes.
And there's probably a whole podcast and things we could talk about this completely separately, but is, when we talk about qualifications and things, is there something that you look for on a CV that you think, oh, this person could well be good? I mean, you know, something like a professional writing MA, is that something where it's a badge of quality, or is it something where the quality of people that have been on a course like that is just as variable as anybody else? Or what do you look for?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because that kind of plays into location as well, because we're based in Cornwall. And, you know, when I set out to hire writers here in Cornwall, in an ideal world, I'd have looked for experience of writing for B2B technology brands, because that's where we specialise. But there aren't that many people in Cornwall who have experience of writing for B2B technology brands who want a job. I mean, there's quite a few very decent freelancers. But so I had to go on different criteria. I had to look for people with the writing skills who we could then train up in the industry and understand the industry. So I did look at the professional writing MA, which Emily and a couple of our other team members here have done as well, because that does give you a grounding in copywriting. And so I think three people on the team here have done that MA. So in the absence of industry experience, then I would look for, and looking to hire people at a relatively junior level, then I have in the past looked for, you know, qualifications like that, yeah. Yeah.
Other than that, if you want people with industry experience, we have to tempt them from other regions.
Well, yes, we do have to tempt them from other regions.
And now we know which regions, where they earn less, so we know where to focus our attentions.
We're going to get them all from Scotland.
We should tempt them with warmer weather, less mozzies, ice cream and beaches.
Yeah, that's right.
But I suppose beyond qualifications and whether or not, because we've just been hitting out, whether or not qualifications pay into it, but it was kind of revealing about what people were saying about pay in their responses. And it kind of revealed that just like with almost any industry, it seems the gender pay gap will not leave us alone.
Oh, yeah. People can't see that I have my head in my hands, but I do. You'd think, if ever there was an industry where it just doesn't matter at all.
Yeah, it's so frustrating because when you start to dig into it, like you did for a blog post recently, David, there's no obvious reason for it. There's no obvious reason behind it. You know, why should there be this disparity? I think it's 28% overall. In agency, it's up to 33% difference between what male agency writers are being paid to what female agency writers are being paid. David, you did some interviews recently with various female writers in different jobs to try to get to the bottom of, you know, what was behind this pay gap. And, you know, you find kind of hints and kind of, you know, insinuations of what might be behind it. But there's nothing you can point to and go, yeah, it's that. And you know, if you can't point to something and go, yeah, it's that, then you can't really start to fix it.
No, it's a tough thing. And the thing that, you know, and I think that virtually everybody said that we spoke to was somehow men come across as more confident, and maybe men don't worry so much about when they're negotiating their freelance rates and their salaries. And, you know, the people saying, well, I change my quote three times before I send it, and I'm kind of, don't we all do that?
Yeah.
You know, kind of anxiety and the kind of imposter syndrome and that kind of thing. And you think, I thought that was common to everybody that kind of claims to go, I'm a writer, because, you know, that everyone else kind of goes, oh, really? But everyone can do that.
Yeah.
You know, I do have a small theory, and I don't want to kind of, you know, sit here with two women and mansplain the gender pay gap. But there was a thing that I noticed, and it's this. The pay gap, the way that they analysed it, only takes into account full copywriters who work full-time.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, out of 610 respondents, 130 of them work part-time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Out of the 130, I'm covering up my notes now, so you can't...
I can't read your handwriting.
That's fine. Yeah, my scribbly handwriting.
I'm out too of, short-sighted to see.
Out of 130 writers who work part-time, how many of them do you think are female?
I would say almost all of them. I'd go for 110.
Yeah.
It's 100.
Oh,
yeah. So 100 out of 130. There were 100, roughly speaking, there were 100 female part-times and 30 male. And I think that's kind of where it comes in. Because when you look at the reporting around the part-time stuff was difficult because they can't really work out who put full-time equivalent and who didn't. There may be a problem there. It might need to be clearer next time. However, looking at it, there appears to be an inverse gender pay gap among part-timers. The female part-timers on average earn 17% more.
Right, yeah.
Now that, and among other things, might suggest that if women were to take a career break and then come back part-time, it later on in their careers when they would be earning more money, they're not being represented in the full-time earnings. So that may account for some of it, which doesn't mean, oh, everything's fine as far as, you know, gender pay and earnings. But then you have an even bigger, broader issue where you're looking at the pressure on society that somehow, you know, that somehow women bring up the kids and men don't, you know, and that's just, that's a whole big scary patriarchy thing. And the thing that was, that for me with the blog post that we wrote was the bit that really jumped out at me, the contrast between your response, Fiona, where, you know, where your husband is able to help the childcare, and the response that we had after that, Jenny, who feels it is, you know, and I'm not going to decry it at all, but feels it is her primal role to look after her kids and has intentionally sacrificed her career to make that happen. And the contrast in that, and there's no reason why one is better than the other, apart from my point of view, apart from what society puts on people.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of that. And I know I did feel a bit weird about going back to work full time and leaving James to look after the kids, because he works for himself very flexibly, so he can work in the evenings, look after the kids during the day. But I did feel odd about that. It felt a little bit like what I shouldn't be doing that. But equally, I mean, I don't think it's all social pressure. I think a lot of women actively want to stay at home and bring up their children, I think. It's not for me.
But why should women want that more than the men want that? We've wandered far from the realms of B2B copywriting. Oh, yeah. But
yeah, we have, and I'm not sure that I've got the answers. In fact, what I found, that's, you know, what you've pointed out there, David, is pretty fundamental to it. It's, you know, whether you feel pressured to or whether you want to, it tends to be the woman that gives up the job to look after the kids. And that's probably part of it. But what I also found interesting is there is this kind of current belief at the moment, and you hear it a lot, that, oh, you know, men are more confident in negotiating and they will negotiate more. And I would just like to say that in my experience, you know, I've hired a lot of people, negotiated with them about a salary, and I've hired a lot of freelancers and talked to them about their rates. I don't see that. Very few people of either gender negotiate or, you know, try to negotiate for more. So I think that maybe there's a bit of that, but I don't think it's the big issue that everybody says it is. Certainly not in the experience that I've had.
I mean, I know that there's, you know, working with some of the agencies that we work with in London, the, you know, the attitude over things like this in London seems to be different. And I know there's a big London and Southeast bias to the results of the report, so that maybe that's into it as well.
I think one of the big other findings beyond pay, beyond training, was whether or not copywriters specialised in the type of copywriting or offered it just in a general kind of service. 55% of respondents said they don't specialise in a type of copywriting.
In a particular type of copywriting?
Yeah, sort of content types or in industry, by sort of industry level, or like, is it business to consumer versus business to business?
And I think that kind of mix was kind of borne out in the copy chat that we did.
Had,
You know, and there were people who were, you know, fairly, you can't really argue with someone saying, if someone's going to pay you to do this writing, you see, you know, it's quite hard to say, no, I don't want to do that.
Although it is quite empowering to say,
yes,
no, I don't do that sort of thing. I only do this, which is where I've always come from. You know, I've turned a lot of work away by saying, you know, I specialise purely in B2B technology, copywriting. That doesn't fit in with what I specialise in. You can probably get a better service elsewhere, you know. I'm probably not the best writer for you because this is where I specialise. And so you kind of carve a niche for yourself, which makes you the expert in that niche and attracts more work of that type. And it also means the client is more likely to get the best copywriter for their needs as well. So I think specialism is a good way to go. I'm surprised more people don't specialise.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think some people sort of do informally, you know, it's like if someone said to me, oh, I've got, you know, I've got some lovely sports and leisure writing, or I've got some lovely culinary writing that needs doing, or something else like that. I think I'd have a picture in my mind out of the writers that I know. Oh, they'd be good at that, and they'd be good at that. And people kind of, whether they consciously specialise or not, I think people do get reputations for having strengths in particular areas.
Yeah, yeah. And I think as long as you don't limit yourself too far, then you're not really denying yourself, you know, a lot of opportunity. I mean, you know, in our space, there's so much opportunity. It's such a big market, you know, writing for, you know, business technology companies. There's an awful lot of writing there. You know, we've had business advisors that said, oh, you know, aren't you limiting yourselves a bit? You know, you're limiting the market and you won't be able to grow. No, I mean, there's a massive opportunity out there. So, yeah, so specialism isn't necessarily limiting yourself too much, I don't think.
Do you think it's harder to make that decision when you're a freelancer or not? You know, it's hard because, you know, if it is very directly, this is the, you know, I know for all of us, it's the writing that puts food on the table, yeah. But for a freelancer.
It was definitely harder for me to say no to stuff. I did some horrible SEO writing, but I went back before Google really updated things, and it was just the nastiest of nasty to write proper.
Did you have to go and have a shower afterwards?
Yeah, a bit. You've got to cram these keywords in and cram this and that. It's like it's not compelling copy at all. It's just purely churning out copy for a search engine to trawl through rather than a human being, and it was unpleasant. And it was obviously before content marketing as well, like taken off as a thing. And I'm so thankful for content marketing in a way, because it's given some evidence for like maybe we shouldn't be churning out crap all the time. That would be nice.
Yeah.
No, I think maybe, and one of the things that came out of this survey actually is that some people seem to go straight into being freelance, you know, with no contacts, and I don't know how much of a portfolio. But I guess if you've got no contacts and not much of a portfolio, then you probably have to take everything that you can get until you can build that up. When I went freelance, I had clients that I brought with me, and so I didn't have to, like, you know, scratch around for work. The work was already there, and so I could specialise right from the start. But I guess some people that start out, you know, I don't know, straight out of university, I'm going to be a freelance copywriter, have to do pretty much
everything
that comes their way. I know.
Although I suppose if you're fresh out of university, you probably don't have a mortgage to worry about.
You're still going to have to pay rent though somewhere, aren't you?
You're staying at mum and dad or something.
So are there any other aspects from the survey's results that really stood out to you guys?
Well, we spoke briefly about where you are in the country and how it affects kind of the way that you work. And I don't know if, I was looking at the figures, I was trying to work out if the fact that more than 40% of respondents are either in London or the South East has thrown everything else off beam. Because what I did is I compared the average freelance day rates with the average full-time earnings. And some of them seem to follow a pattern, and then some of them are just completely weird. It's like, the freelance day rates in Yorkshire and Scotland are 252 and 254, respectively. The income is 35,000 and 25,000, respectively.
You say in Scotland they just don't do any work?
Yeah, I don't know if they just work a lot. That's all those. Everyone's listening in Yorkshire going, yeah. I'm not going to do a Yorkshire accent. I was tempted, but I won't, because that would be borderline racist to Yorkshire people. You know, but they'll say, oh, well, you know, well, we work hard, don't we? You know, but that's like 100. One's 140 times the other, and one's 98 times the other. It's like 1.40, and you kind of go, how does that work? And then you kind of look at it again and work out that, well, only 3% of the respondents were from Scotland. That's like 18 people or 20 people or something at over. So maybe it's just a statistical thing. But it was odd. It was odd that, you know, that London, the you know, the income and the day rates were just so much higher. And it's, I can understand if you live in London, why you would charge more. Because you have to, because living in London is eye-wateringly expensive.
Yeah.
I get that. What I don't get is why, you know, with the greatest of respect to our colleagues in London, why anybody would pay a premium, you know, they think it was on average an £80 a day premium for someone to be in London.
Mm.
There's relatively, do you find, I mean, you know, you have to travel to London a lot,
yes.
But do you find that there's, you know, how much is there to do that you can't do from, you know, somewhere here where we can walk to the beach from our office?
It's not a very nice beach.
It's rather a muddy beach. But
I find this strange, especially from my point of view, because, you know, I've worked in London and I've done this job in London and I've done this job in the home counties and I've moved to the rural south of France and done the same job and I've moved to Cornwall here and done the same job. And it's the same job, you know, it's the same type of client, it's the same type of writing, it's writing that I've done, so the quality is the same. So I've always charged the same, mm. You know, no matter where I live. I don't think that has any bearing on how much I charge, because I charge what I think is the right rate for the value that I provide in terms of the copy that I write. So I think where a lot of this is coming from is that probably the writers that work in London are working on the big brands. Mm. And so the big brands have got big budgets. And so there's more budget available for copywriters in London and around London. And I think that you'll probably find that a lot of the writers who are based in the you know, regions outside London are working for more local brands, possibly, where the budgets are smaller and therefore they don't want to pay so much for copywriting. So I don't know, I think that's probably where it comes from, but it doesn't have to be like that.
But I don't think, for example, our London agency clients suffer from us being here. You know, they can always talk to us when they need
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
You know, we can always do a conference call, we can always Skype, we can always get on a 5:38 train.
Yes,
you know,
and we often do. Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think that there's any reason. I mean, do you think that, obviously there are many good reasons, but do you think we would get more work if we were in London? You know, on the doorsteps of the big agencies there or not?
Well, no, because I've done that. you know, I've run a similar agency setup in London. And I don't see any difference in the volume of work that we get from being based in Cornwall, from the volume of work that we got being based in London. So no, I don't see any difference. But then, you know, we specialise in global B2B tech firms.
Quite.
You know,
it's the same firm. They're not in this country.
Lots of them aren't in this country. Exactly.
Well, no,
it's
absolutely.
A very virtual setup. They're used to virtual working. They're used to people not being there. And so, you know, it doesn't really make that much of a difference.
That's the thing. I mean, I explain it to people and they look at me like open-mouthed. And I say, how does that work when you work for clients in London? I go, well, think about it being clients in London. That's only part of the chain. And they go, what do you mean? And I say, well, you know, the other week I found myself sitting at a desk in Cornwall working on an email because a software company in San Francisco had decided to ask their marketing people in New Jersey to ask an agency in London, who asked a copywriting agency in Cornwall to write an email to a company executive in Amsterdam and ask them to go to an event in San Francisco.
Yeah, this is the way the industry works.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, there is no difference from my point of view. It's whether we're in London or whether we're in Cornwall.
The only thing you need to think about is, from your point of view, I'm that company in San Francisco talking to that executive in Amsterdam.
Exactly, yeah.
Is there anything else that's up for anyone before? I think we can fit maybe one more thing in, but that'll be it.
Well, it's quite a trivial point compared with the other ones that we've talked about.
Good, finish the trivial, we like
just,
that.
I was quite gratified to see, because I've had this sense, because I come across a lot of very good writers here in Cornwall and the West Country, I kind of had this sense that good writers gravitate west.
Go west!
If they're not here already, then they seem to gravitate in this direction. And so when I looked at the breakdown of, you know, where the respondents were to this survey, The Southwest was the third biggest region after London and the Southeast. So I felt slightly vindicated, thinking, yeah, maybe my perception and my hunch was right. Yeah.
Where would you count to Southwest?
Well, the Southwest.
You're counting Bristol.
The Southwest region in the survey is quite big. Yeah, it's not as big as Scotland, though.
No, that's true.
So, yeah, it is kind of Bristol. It probably starts at Chippenham or somewhere like that.
Yes, Swindon.
So it's quite a big area. Yeah. But even so, I do feel a bit vindicated, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, there are obviously lots of good agencies in Bristol, and that might buoy the figures. But obviously, yes, the message is, you know, if you're a good writer in another part of the country and you're not yet in the Southwest, that should be your next career move.
We may have a job for you.
Look out for our next job.
That is all we've got time for this episode of Good Copy, Bad Copy. So we have to wind it up.
Oh.
So you can follow Radix on Twitter at RadixCon, and you'll find our website at radix-communications.com, where you can also sign up for a monthly email with the latest copywriting tips and insights. If you've got any, you know, thoughts about what this survey, you know, show people, you know, tweet us, comment on the episode. Yeah, just
put something in there. Put a comment on the blog post.
Yeah, you do that. We had a lot of conversation from the copy chat, and I'll make sure that we've got the copy chat story 5, which has all the best tweets linked to on the post as well.
We're just going
to
get so much abuse from Scottish copywriters.
Oh, we'll be fine.